You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire Parahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. E whai akane, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government not announcing they would recognise a Palestinian state and the government's new Employment Act. On Friday, I spoke to Nick Wilson, a public health professor at the University of Otago, Wellington, about a new study showing a majority of New Zealanders in the study want the government to develop specific plans in case of catastrophic risks to the nation. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to senior lecturer in accountancy and finance at the University of Otago, Dr. Sebastian Gerke, about Winston Peters' comments to the UN about top emitters and what it means for Aotearoa's climate approach. I also spoke to senior tutor in law at the University of Auckland, Dr. Justin Subion, about the problems with the UN, the Security Council, and how these can be fixed.
Hey, aho whakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e ware ware e ahe na koutou, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrodono, hei a pakihiri rokiroki mārongi te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text rima toru iwa rima 5395, or call toru kore iwa toru waru fitu iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Over the weekend at the United Nations General Assembly, Foreign Minister Winston Peters announced that New Zealand would not formally recognise a Palestinian state. This follows weeks of the government not explicitly laying out what their plans were regarding recognising Palestine, unlike countries such as France, the UK, Canada and Australia, who all announced they would be recognising a Palestinian state. The government's decision to not recognise a Palestinian state has received criticism from the opposition parties, international relations experts and pro-Palestinian advocates. For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to the ACT Party's Simon Court about the country's decision not to recognise a Palestinian state. We also discussed the government overhauling the Holidays Act. The changes include a shift to hours-based accrual system for annual leave and a 12.5% leave compensation payment for casual employees as opposed to accruing leave. I also spoke to Simon about this topic, specifically about its impact on casual and part-time employees. But first, we discussed the government's decision not to recognise Palestine. Before Peter's announcement, the minister took two options to cabinet. One would have recognised a Palestinian state with certain conditions, or continue the country's when, not if approach. Why have we gone with the second option here?
Well, at present, there's no legitimate unified Palestinian government that has control over its territory or population. It's just not clear that recognising statehood now would move the parties closer to peace. And in fact, what Winston Peters, our foreign minister, was very clear on is that premature recognition of a Palestinian state at this time would in fact embolden Hamas, which attacked Israel on October 7, 2023, killed over 1,000 people, still holds, you know, maybe 50 people hostage, of which 20 are still alive. And that to recognise a Palestinian state at this time would essentially embolden them, and they regard it as a win. And of course they would, because after the Australian Prime Minister gave his speech saying that they'd recognise a Palestinian state, Hamas basically sent him a bouquet and put out a press release and a statement saying, thank you, the struggle was and the sacrifice was worth it. That is not the kind of reward that New Zealand wants for recognising a Palestinian state. It's not the kind of reward that the Palestinian people deserve more Hamas taking the credit for this stuff.
A RNZ Reid poll from early this month shows that 42.5% of New Zealanders were for recognising the state of Palestine, as opposed to 22.1%. 35.4% were unsure. Despite being quite divisive in this poll, more are in favour of recognising Palestine as a state. Does this move by the government not go against the best interests of New Zealanders?
Well, I think New Zealanders are rightly troubled by the suffering of civilians in Gaza, and it's right that New Zealand calls for a ceasefire and humanitarian access so that aid can get to civilians and for the release of the hostages that Hamas hold. I think some New Zealanders might think that recognising a Palestinian state is somehow going to solve those problems, which were caused by Hamas attacking Israel on October 7. And so I understand the sentiment, but when you get down to the nitty-gritty, and that's what our Foreign Minister Winston Peters has been doing in New York last week, is meeting with regional leaders, meeting with the leaders of Qatar and Jordan and other nations to find out what they think, what's really going on. It turns out that actually recognising a Palestinian state at this time is not going to get aid to people who need it. It's not going to get the hostages released. It's not going to disarm Hamas. In fact, it's likely to have the opposite effect, because Hamas will simply be emboldened by believing that their actions are able to divide the West. Most NATO countries have not recognised Palestine. So I think it's important that New Zealand has independently drawn the conclusion that if we're going to recognise a Palestinian state, we want that to be impactful, and we want it to be recognising a state that actually can succeed.
ACT Party leader David Seymour said following Peter's speech that he is proud of this government for showing independence in foreign policy. However, a lot of people speculate that this is us just cozying up to the US. We've recently seen a standalone FBI office open up on our shores, and we are currently facing 15% tariffs. What do you say to these claims?
Well, it sounds like a conspiracy theory by these people when, if you look at the more likely conclusion, that is that our foreign minister, who has decades of experience as having been a foreign minister under multiple New Zealand governments, he took advice, considered all of the evidence, went to New York after having made some draft recommendations to cabinet, interviewed and met with more people, took more advice, and drew a conclusion that I think is backed by evidence and also closely aligned with New Zealand's interests. Recognising a state that doesn't have borders, doesn't have a functioning government, where half the territory is controlled by, remember, an elected Hamas terrorist organisation. They won an election in 2006 or 7, and there's never been one since. Who knew? You elect militant Islamist fighters to run your country. You don't think they're going to let you have another election, do they? So, look, now is definitely not the right time to recognise a Palestinian state. We don't need to tune into TV news in the US or, ask the FBI what to do. The evidence is there.
Labour Foreign Affairs spokesperson Pini Hinare says Luxon had a chance to stand up for what is right, but he failed. There is no two-state solution or enduring peace in the Middle East without recognition of Palestine as a state. And that we've watched an unfolding genocide on our screens for nearly 2 years. This government is failing to take any of the action required to help stop the atrocities and suffering of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians in Gaza. Is this government doing enough to support Palestinians here, especially as the death toll in Gaza reaches over 66,000?
Well, certainly New Zealand is doing what it can and should, which is to donate aid and make it very clear what New Zealand's expectations are about the conduct of military operations by the Israeli forces, that they must protect civilians, they must get people out of harm's way while they engage with enemy combatants, with Hamas, who are holding hostages and bunkers and terror tunnels under Gaza. So, of course, New Zealand has done what it should and can, but New Zealand can't wave a magic wand and free the people of Palestine from Hamas. You can't wave a magic wand and bring peace to the Middle East. That's farcical. And what the New Zealand government is doing by saying we're setting that to one side, the policy is when, not if, a Palestinian state should be created. But you know, let's get back and focus on what New Zealanders need us to do. You know, we have hospitals that need upgrades, and we have people who need operations. You know, we have schools and that are desperately needed in fast-growing areas in places like Auckland, where I live. This government has enough on its plate without, you know, pretending it can solve Middle East peace. We'll leave that to people in opposition to pretend they can solve it. This government has a whole lot of other things that we need to fix, because that's why Kiwis voted for us.
Do you believe the country's lack of recognition here will affect the Coalition's chance of a re-election in next year's general elections?
I think New Zealanders will understand that our Foreign Minister and our Cabinet have made a decision based on evidence, and they will expect this government to get on with fixing what matters, which is making sure that the infrastructure that we need to deliver, you know, new highways, wastewater, drinking water for our cities, you know, finishing the city rail link, and then if you live in Auckland, you'll know that all of those level crossings that approach the city need to be replaced, so we can actually get the trains to run on time and you don't have people stuck in traffic for hours. All of these are real problems that need fixing, and New Zealanders are asking this government to focus on fixing what matters. That's what's going to count in the next election.
On to our next topic. The government is moving forward to replace the country's leave legislation with the new Employment Act. Why are we seeing this replacement?
Well, because for years the Holidays Act has been so complex, it's hard for employers to follow, and incredibly confusing for workers to understand as well. It's led to billions of dollars in payroll errors and back payments, you know, being held up for years because the legislation was so complicated to work out and comply with. And that's why this government is doing something that people have asked for decades, which is to replace the old Holidays Act with an Employment Leave Act. It's going to be really, really simple. People are going to earn leave for every hour they work, rather than have it accrued on a weekly basis. Sick leave will be accrued in hours, so you can take exactly what you've earned. And parents returning from parental leave won't have to wait for a full year after they return to have accrued enough leave to take time off. The system as it currently works has got so many bizarre anomalies. This is going to transform the way employers and employees deal with leave, holidays and sick leave. You know, and if you're a casual, as I know so many people who be listening to 95BFM would be, you know, working while they study, they're going to earn a 12.5% on top of their hourly rate as a holiday and sick leave contribution. They won't need to worry about, am I eligible for sick leave? They'll get it paid for every hour they work.
You kind of touched on a little bit of my last question here, but many part-time and casual workers are concerned about their changes in holiday and sick leave. How should these workers be guaranteed that this new system will provide them more support compared to the current system?
Well, casual workers currently get 8% extra in recognition of holiday pay. And the new Employment Leave Act is going to bump that up to 12.5%. So that additional 4.5% will cover sick leave and give them a bit more buffer because, you know, there is some uncertainty around casual work. But you compare it to what we have now. Apparently now casual workers technically get 10 sick days a year, but most can't actually use them because of how the rules work. So instead of having sick leave apparently they're eligible for that they can't access because of technical reasons, they're actually going to get paid for it up front. Now, one clear set of rules means workers know what they're owed. Employers can finally get it right without having to seek expensive employment law advice just to resolve basic payroll issues. Like, this is literally fixing what matters. This is what the Coalition government was elected to do.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the government not recognising Palestine at the UN and the overhaul of the Holidays Act.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Last week at a United Nations climate summit, Foreign Affairs Minister Winston Peters pointed what he called the elephant in the room, that in order to rein in emissions, the top four countries in terms of emissions at 60% of the world's emissions must do their part. While there is validity to these claims, and they offer a welcome contrast to the climate denialism of leaders such as US President Donald Trump, there are still concerns over what these claims may mean in terms of Aotearoa's own responsibilities and approach to climate change and action. I spoke to Senior Lecturer in Accountancy and Finance at the University of Otago, Dr. Sebastian Gerke, about these claims and how they may reflect the government's approach to Aotearoa's emissions responsibilities. For starters, looking at the minister's claims, is he correct?
Yeah, so I think he's mostly correct. If you include the EU in his list, then it's over 60%. If you take them out, I think it's about 54%. But it's, you know, his point stands that, you know, most of the emissions globally are caused by those four nations. And I'm grateful that he's calling on them to do more action. However, that does not excuse New Zealand from doing less. And in the last, you know, couple of years, we've been walking back a lot of climate policy in New Zealand.
In terms of the responsibility of these big emitters, are we likely to see the improvements that Peter's called for?
Probably not in the very near term, but even the day before Peter spoke, China released their new emissions reduction targets, which are their first targets ever to actually reduce emissions from their peak. So you are seeing progress from some of them. All of the countries are part of the Paris Agreement, although the US has withdrawn under the Trump presidency, but they did that last time as well. So I would expect after the next US election, they may rejoin the Paris Agreement. I think the issue really here is that it's a bit like the pot calling the kettle black. It's, you know, trying to wave off our own responsibility by pointing out in absolute terms how large the emissions are of these much larger countries is not really a fair comparison. If you wanted to compare New Zealand to those other countries, you would have to look at, you know, emissions per person. And so annual emissions per person, I think New Zealand is sort of in the top 15. And if you look at emissions total, sort of since the Industrial Revolution until today, and you divide that by the number of people in the country, right, so you make it relative to the population size, New Zealand is, by some calculations, the highest emitting country. So we certainly have a responsibility to do a lot more than we are, and this is a global challenge. So, you know, I'm glad he's calling out those largest emitters, but that should not excuse us from doing our part.
I mean, you've just said it there, but how might this shifting of blame kind of undermine our own efforts and commitments and responsibilities to climate action?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but it is a bit strange. I mean, our last emissions reduction plan is not very ambitious. Our NDC looks to not be very ambitious. So, yeah, and the current coalition government has clawed back, you know, for example, shutting down the New Zealand Green Investment Finance, cutting EV subsidies, changing road user charges to incentivise more fossil fuel vehicles, essentially, bringing back fossil fuel exploration subsidies and fast-tracking coal mine projects. So you can already see, you know, our current government has already been taking these actions. I'm not sure exactly how that relates to this, but maybe that's more of an elephant in the room locally than, you know, pointing out the obvious that the largest countries are doing the largest emissions.
Thinking kind of cynically, is there a chance that Winston Peters' comments are kind of reflective of that intent from the government to continue to kind of shirk those climate responsibilities?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen anything in terms of actual policy decisions that has gone in the other direction, right? Most of the policy decisions have been sort of reducing our efforts on climate change rather than increasing them. The rhetoric might be otherwise sometimes, but if you look at the actual decisions made and policies changed, we're certainly going backwards on our ambition.
With that in mind then, if we are to take Peters' comments seriously, what should New Zealand's behaviour for climate policy look like?
I mean, his call for more agreements and getting more commitment from other countries, I mean, that's his role as foreign minister, and that's something we have to work on.
But we do, like I said, we have the Paris Agreement. We were part of the Kyoto Protocol before that. We have free trade agreement with the EU that has very strong commitments for sustainability. And so we really just need to follow through on our promises. And so I would be very hopeful that, that climate policy being, you know, a really good driver of change, that ambition would increase. Maybe that will come after the next election, maybe it will come before. But certainly that's what I would love to see is bringing in some of those policies back, or at least replacing them with something that can make a change.
And would enacting these changes that you've just spoken of kind of help us to find some sort of balance between these more maybe realistic visions of who's the biggest emitters and what we ourselves can do?
Yeah, I mean, what we do domestically is somewhat independent of what other countries are doing, right? Because we have the Paris Agreement, we've agreed to do our most ambitious possible effort. And so that's what we need to be doing, and we're just not at the moment. The government may have a view around the emissions trading scheme being the, you know, main policy tool, but that has a whole lot of issues still. Even though it's been around for many years, we've never seen the political willpower to actually enact the changes to make that a functioning policy tool. And, you know, climate policy is really important because it brings those long-term risks and long-term potential damages. It brings that into the current decision-making horizon for both investors and business leaders. For a lot of them, without policy, those risks are too far away to drive change today. Yeah, just the overall trend of saying we want to do something or pointing the finger at other countries, as in this case, while we walk back policy in action, right? So I think it's really important that we sort out the ETS. I think it's important that we figure out the best way to incentivize electrification and decarbonization across all industries. And the emissions trading scheme, if we can fix the issues in that, is one part of that. But there's also, there will be need to be some subsidies or other costs imposed. And, you know, some of these enabling policies that we had and that I was hoping would grow rather than diminish. But really overall, I think the key message here is that, you know, we can't be the pot calling the kettle black. We need to act ourselves before we start pointing the finger at others. And we, as New Zealand, are endowed with fantastic resources and a great starting point with our mostly renewable electricity generation infrastructure, that we shouldn't have any excuses.
That was the University of Otago's Dr. Sebastian Gericke on Winston Peters' claims about top emitters and what that should mean for Aotearoa's own emissions.
I know you must have another question, so I'll shut up.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Excuse me, listeners. We've got an announcement to make. Our very own Gang of Four are headed to Verona for a live broadcast, and you're invited. Friday, October 10th, 7 till 9 p.m.
So come have a bevy and listen live to the on-point selections of these 95 BFM icons, Renee, Pat, Phil and the Professor.
95 BFM Gang of Four at Verona, Friday, October 10th, from 7 till 9 p.m.
Thanks to Verona and Decibel Wines.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95bfm.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums and more.
It's music.
95BFM.
Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
watching the old man playing backgammon out on the terrace, feeling that specific heat reserved only for panic. When the regime changed, the dollar dropped, and now your money means nothing. Now it all means nothing. Still shrouded in rejected religion. My quivering heart on the cold skin.
That was Nick Sick by the Beatniks, and before that was Backgammon by our beloved Ditch. Welcome back, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Last week, US President Donald Trump had an outburst of criticism towards the UN. Despite the why and what of these criticisms by the right-wing leader, he is not the first to levy criticisms against the organization and its structures. Particularly, the inability for the organization to enact, oversee, and rule on meaningful change, as well as the powers invested in an outdated Security Council, have been subject of significant concern, especially in the 21st century. I spoke to senior tutor in law at the University of Auckland, Dr. Justin Subion, about the UN's glaring issues and potential fixes. Generally speaking, what are some of the main concerns with the UN?
Yeah, there are some concerns. And the thing is, as you rightly said, Donald Trump and other leaders have been saying this for quite a long time. So it's not only Donald Trump that the UN has, it has potential, but there's still a lot of work to be done. We saw, for example, Helen Clark, a former prime minister, saying the same thing. And it's not often you have Helen Clark and persons like Donald Trump agreeing on certain things. So there seems to be some commonality where that is concerned. And the thing is, the organization, the point to be made is that the organization is 80 years old. It was founded in 1945, the UN Charter, as a post-war kind of architecture of how to move, this is post-World War II, how to move the nations further, how to move the nations forward, coming out of a barbaric world war. And so the three pillars of the United Nations, peace and security, human rights and development. But now we are in the 21st century, and I think the UN has 20th century pegs trying to fit into 21st century holes, if you want to use a metaphor like that. So the UN Security Council, for example, the UN Security Council really were the P5 who have the right of veto. They were the victors in the World War, so that's the US, World War II, that is, US, China, Russia, France, and the United Kingdom. And these five countries have the power to veto anything that comes before it. I saw a statement this weekend, I think it was from the Kenyan Prime Minister. He was saying at the UN that a continent that represents 54 countries, they don't even have a permanent seat in the United Nations Security Council. So things like that, you know, we want more diverse membership, especially for permanent members, or maybe you scrap the whole permanent membership and, you know, you let more countries be engaged. Maybe you have to scrap the veto power as well, because there are a lot of crucial matters coming before it. And another thing which I believe that needs reform would be, as I said, the three pillars, peace and security, human rights, development. We notice that climate change or the environment is not even a pillar or one of the main aims and objectives of the UN. Of course, in 1945, climate change wasn't seen as a huge threat as it is today. So climate change needs to be there. Some argue that peace and security could amount to climate change. That's a kind of vague argument, you know. So I think the whole mission or the pillars of the UN need to change. And lastly, I just want to talk about the UN Trusteeship Council, which is one of the principal organs, one of the six principal organs of the United Nations. And that body is now defunct. There are various amendments or various proposals over the last 25 years, I think even from the beginning of the 21st century in 2000, to transform the UN Trusteeship Council as an institution that overlooks the global commons. In other words, looks at trusteeship, how do we manage the atmosphere, how do we manage Antarctica, how do we manage oceans. And that proposal has just been kind of spinning top in mud in the UN, and they haven't really come to a decision. So I think things like these, you know, we need to rehash. The last thing was that it should be repurposed, the Trusteeship Council, as being a trusteeship organization that looks after the global environment. So I think that member states, of course, act in that role.
In looking at the kind of background of the UN, especially looking at how, you know, how it came about post-World War II, how does that kind of, as you said, 20th century pegs, how does that kind of maybe reflect in the way that the UN's been dealing with recent conflicts like Russia's invasion of Ukraine or Israel's genocide in Gaza?
Yeah, that's another big issue, and the U.S. president did speak about that as well, seeing that they are not handling conflicts well. And of course, people say the UN is a talk shop, which in essence is true. But I think it comes again to the Security Council. The Security Council needs more teeth. They're the ones that are responsible for what's going on. I mean, there are numerous vetoes that have been passed in what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on even in Myanmar. Some people tend to forget about that. And some people even forget about the unspoken genocide that's going on in Sudan right now. It's actually more persons have been killed in Sudan than in Gaza. And that has been a kind of unforgotten genocide right now. So I think what needs to be done is definitely all the security measures that pass through the Security Council that are responsible for peace and security, that whole veto thing needs to really be dropped. And you should have a diverse range of members. So I think the UN really needs to get into these type of nitty-gritty issues. And especially, as we said, climate change, the climate crisis is just something that really spurred upon us in the last 20, 30 years. Especially this decade, the UN.
And alongside rehashing some of these mechanisms like the trusteeship or the Security Council, what can the UN maybe do, or what can be done within the UN to greater increase its actual effectiveness in enacting some of these decisions, whether or not they pass or not?
Yeah, I think what we also need is the Secretary General, to be quite honest, hands are always tied. I know a lot of people say, yeah, but do something. Maybe expel certain countries from the UN. I think there's a power you can trigger to do that. But the Secretary General's hands are really tied. What we really need is multilateralism needs to be more repose of trust and confidence, because I think we don't have trust and confidence within states themselves. So that is one issue. We need international morality, right? I think when you look at the larger schemes of things, the morality has really gone down. They are broken promises. There are wars. If you look at the doomsday clock, we are, I think, that was set up by scientists headed by Albert Einstein many years ago. We are like a few seconds before midnight when a grand catastrophe is supposed to happen. So I think international morality is clearly lacking, and we just need to work in multilateralism. The world is polarized, and states have not been able to trust each other, and that's the reality. Some people say we're on the brink of World War III, which I hope not, but you know, I think we are really at a cusp of something really big, and I think we can, if we could just pivot along and realize that we're working along common goals, we could avoid any major disaster. So I think states just need to really be working with themselves and trusting each other in the multilateral process.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Justin Subion on the problems with the UN and how they can potentially be solved.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Second sleep is calling out to me. If I don't wake up, oh, I have the sense not to make a mess. Just to hurt myself. Time to toughen up. Gotta get some.
Fuck your life, it's bare room, asshole. Dead weight, it's lit human race. UKIP and your disgrace. Chopped heads on London streets. All you zombies, tweet, tweet, tweet. This is a human race. UKIP and your disgrace. Chopped heads on London streets. All you zombies, tweet, tweet, tweet.
That was Clark by Bar Italia. Before that was Tweet, Tweet, Tweet by Sleaford Mods. And before that was Second Step by Magdalena Bay. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM.
You know, our call is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay, it's BFM.
The Wire.
In a recently released study from the University of Otago, researchers surveyed over 1,000 participants, with over two-thirds of these participants supporting the idea of the government developing plans to deal with catastrophes extending across the political spectrum. Such catastrophes include nuclear war, the spread of bioengineered infectious diseases, and weather events. On Friday, I spoke to senior researcher and a population health professor at the University of Otago Wellington, Nick Wilson, about the study and what the government already has in place to deal with these risks.
What was the inspiration behind the study? Why look into this now?
So we did this research in response to really the growing international concern around catastrophic risk. Risk arising from such threats as nuclear war in the Northern Hemisphere, or the threat from bioengineered pandemics, or even AI going rogue. So there's a range of catastrophic risks that really have been neglected in government planning. So we focused on those. And actually our survey showed that New Zealanders, as you said, a majority of them favoured the government developing specific plans to deal with these extreme risks. And there was also majority support for establishing a commission or an agency to monitor and report on these types of extreme risks. So we were Pleased to see that actually the support was widespread across different social groups, and even it didn't vary by political orientation. So people on the right and left of the political spectrum both seemed to think that, there was a role for government to protect society from these sort of risks. We think that this really gives the government a mandate for action in this area to maybe establish a dedicated agency. And I mean, that could even be done in partnership with Australia, because Australia faces many of these similar catastrophic risks. And the government could even just have a designated role like a chief risk officer. And these type of roles are common in industry. For example, Air New Zealand, that where Prime Minister Luxon used to work, I mean, it's got a chief risk officer. But the New Zealand government doesn't have that role, and yet we really need it to be able to look across these various risks and think about how we can both prevent them, but also to build resilience if prevention fails and we have to face these type of catastrophes.
Now, if we're looking at these risks, and you mentioned a couple such as nuclear warfare, rogue artificial intelligence, and bioengineered infectious diseases, this may be a bit too early to say, but where are we most at risk?
Well, these risks are changing rapidly, and part of that is the development of new technology. So with bioengineered pandemics, you have developments in biotechnology that making it easier to for these type of new pathogens to be synthesized. And actually, artificial intelligence can also help accelerate that progress. So those are areas where the risk is various expert authorities think there's real concern there for increased risk. And unfortunately, also, we're going backwards on nuclear arms control, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine has increased the risk of nuclear war as well, with Russia frequently referring to its nuclear arsenal and threatening in various ways to use it. And unfortunately, also, we're going backwards on arms control, with a number of arms control treaties lapsing or being various parties leaving them. So, yeah, the international situation is very concerning in terms of the risk of either various conventional warfare expanding or nuclear war as well. So those are areas of great concern. But there are some catastrophic risks that we absolutely know will occur in the future, and that is, we know that there can be large volcanic eruptions that block the sunlight. That's happened multiple times in the last 2,000 years with volcanic winters that have often caused famines. And we know also that there can be major solar storms that could potentially wreck electrical grids. And we know from tree ring studies that there's been multiple solar storms over the last few thousand years. And so this provides another potential catastrophic risk, where our electrical grid could be fried in an extreme solar storm. So there's many of these type of catastrophes. Similar resilience building measures could occur that made New Zealand more robust to survive them. But there's just a marked lack of planning by government to even talk about these risks.
You've briefly touched on my next question a little bit here, but currently, how prepared are we for these risks, these events? What frameworks are already in place to deal with these forms of catastrophes?
Well, New Zealand is getting better and better at emergency management, unfortunately, because we're getting more climate-related disasters. So we're getting better at dealing with things like floods and extreme weather events, and we've got some planning around earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. But our planning is very localised just to New Zealand, and we haven't really explored planning for global catastrophes where the whole world is affected. So that's where we really need to improve the situation. And we come from a very good starting point in that New Zealand's a geographically remote island nation. So that means there's some protection against things like nuclear winter and also volcanic winter. And because we're an island, we can close our borders, so that may help with future extreme pandemics. So we're well positioned, but we also lack areas of resiliency so that even though we're a great food producer, all our agricultural machinery runs on imported diesel. So we have no refining capacity in this country to produce biofuels for our machinery. So that's an area of obvious need for improved resiliency so that we can keep our machinery running after various catastrophes that block trade internationally.
I want to go a bit more in depth to that last point there, because that pretty much touches on quite a lot of my last question here. You mentioned our geographic location. We are quite isolated from the rest of the world and therefore a lot more safe from some of these events like nuclear winter, for example. However, in the event of such a catastrophic event that impacts countries overseas, our trading partners, how important is it that we become more self-reliant in this sort of situation?
Well, we're already super self-sufficient in food production. In fact, we're a major food exporter. So we have no trouble in terms of producing food. But as I mentioned, the inputs to that food production, we're vulnerable. So we import a lot of fertilizer. We import various agricultural chemicals. And critically, we import all the diesel to run farm machinery and to run trucks, for example. So we need to do things like electrify our transport system more, electrify our farm machinery more, and have that capacity to turn things like canola into biodiesel to keep agricultural machinery and trucking and so on running. So we're in a very good position in many ways, but we have these weak links that we just are not even considering. Even though doing some of these things would be good for everyday life, you know, if we had a more electrified railway system and so on, that would be good for greenhouse gas emissions now and build resiliency for smaller, you know, local disasters as well. So there's quite a lot of win-wins when you improve resiliency for the whole of society.
And summarising our chat, and you've also touched on this a bit as well, but ideally, what would catastrophe preparation look like?
Yeah, it needs to really look at all aspects of society so that we build resiliency at different levels of government, so that if central government is not working so well, local government can be stronger. So we need to build those governance systems and have more community participation and more effective democracy so that if there's problems at the central level, you can still have society functioning very well at the local level. We need to look at the food system. As I said, you know, there's some vulnerabilities there. We need to look at the transport system and energy systems, the communication system. We're very dependent on things like the internet, and yet, you know, we need to understand how things like that can be kept going, how we can keep the electrical grid working without relying on imported parts, being able to make those spare parts ourselves, and so on. I mean, as I said, we're in a good position in many ways. We're already got very good hydropower, and we're expanding our solar power and wind power and so on. But we're still very, you know, in terms of liquid fuels, we're super dependent. And I think, you know, as a society, we're very psychologically dependent on things like the internet. And yet we don't know if we could really sustain those things in some types of catastrophes, even though, you know, having a functioning internet would be a very good thing for community communication and so on.
That was the University of Otago Wellington's Nick Wilson on a recent study showing a majority of New Zealanders surveyed want the government to implement plans to deal with catastrophic risks.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, the University of Otago's Dr. Sebastian Gerike, the University of Otago Wellington's Nick Wilson, and the University of Auckland's Justin Sobian. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.